Welcome to the Shamanism Global Summit, an extraordinary gathering of teachers and healers from around the planet, sharing insights, principles, and rituals for personal and collective healing and transformation. Please share this event with your friends and family, and come join us on Facebook at The Shift Network. And now your host, Michael Stone.
Welcome back to this segment of the Shift Network Shamanism Global Summit. I'm your host, Michael Stone, and I'm excited to have my friend Daniel Giammario on today. He's the founder of the Shamanic Astrology Mystery School, linking astrology and astronomy with an experiential, ceremonial, and shamanic framework. He particularly loves working with ancient megalithic, neolithic, and indigenous traditions and connecting them with the current age, ceremonially intended to create a renaissance, accessing ancient knowledge to inspire a global and sustainable future. Well, welcome, Daniel. Looking forward to our chat today.
Michael, it's great to see you. I'm very happy to be able to have this discussion with you.
You too. Well, first of all, there'd be a lot of people who are wondering, well, what makes this shamanic astrology? Can you talk a little bit about that in comparison to other contemporary shamanic and ancient methodologies?
Well, the way that we're approaching this is actually more similar to the way it was done in ancient times. We can't entirely go back to how it was done before. We can be inspired by how it was before. But the reason that we have termed this shamanic astrology is first of all, because we're very much emphasizing the journey that is about being fully human. Rather than wanting to go anywhere else, it's about bringing spirit into matter, the journey that's called involution. So we're dealing with our experience as authentic human beings on the planet and not needing to go anywhere else. I mean, that's one of the reasons, because basically all shamanism would believe that. I mean, it's about being here. It's just like in Tibetan Bun shamanism. It's not about getting off the wheel. It's about bringing consciousness more deeply into who we are as human beings and along with the other species on the planet, you know, animals and plants and the honoring of the entire earth itself. Secondly, I think we call it this because it requires having an experiential connection to the planets. You know, so we're like forming a dialogue with the planetary essences in much the same way that other kinds of shamans might have that kind of relationship with plant medicine or with animals. And with the plants and so on. What we're doing is having the same kind of dialogue with the night sky, with the planetary essences, and also with the seasons and the cycles, and having that kind of relationship with the cosmos and with the cosmology. In our school, we don't have anyone be certified to do these techniques unless they do know the sky also. So it's a part of it is linking sacred astronomy, or the way astronomy was understood before, wasn't disconnected from the spiritual journey. It wasn't mechanistic, linear science, but it was a way of linking astrology and astronomy. Most of the ancient great astronomers were also astrologers. You know, so shamanic astrology would refer to an approach to astrology that emphasizes our direct experience of the land and the sky. My gosh, there's so many astrologers today that they have no experience experientially with the sky, or with the seasons and cycles. It's just like a left brain head trip, and they're relying on traditions that went down 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago, which don't relate to the current culture whatsoever. You know, so I mean, my own journey on this came with a vision quest that I did up on Mount Shasta back in the early 1980s with a remarkable person that I'm so glad that I had the opportunity to know, Joan Halifax, a former head of the Ojai Foundation. And she was running vision quests in the 1980s. And that changed everything. That's when I realized that astrology can't not be some Eastern path, you know, but must connect with the land. And that's basically when the mountain sort of came in and met me and said, hey, if you're going to be an astrologer, and I had been an astrologer since 1970, but I'd done it more the intellectual way, I guess you could say, or the left brain way, but not with that direct experience of the land and the sky. So I took a lot of apprenticeship training with stones, with certain Native American teachers, a vision quest apprenticeship, and so on. And I started taking people out to have the same experiences. And that's how our school happened.
I love that you actually take your students out into nature, into the stars, and really connect them with it. One of the things I think that's really unique about your brand of astrology, your shamanic astrology, is, you know, there's this annoying question that people often ask you, what's your sign? Right. And they usually mean, what's your sun sign?
Exactly.
You don't put a lot of emphasis on that. So talk a little bit about where you put the emphasis in shamanic astrology.
Well, first of all, just very quickly, the whole sun sign thing is more of a fashion. And it's a fashion that has only been there since the 1800s, when it became clear that you could categorize people simply by when they were born during the year. It's not completely irrelevant, but it doesn't really get into the depth that's necessary to see astrology to be of any help in a journey of the soul. So we're much more interested in the moon position, Venus and Mars, what's coming up over the eastern horizon when you're born. Just as an ingredient of this would be that from a shamanic perspective, I mean, we think the moon, you know, your moon is who you used to be. It's your lineage. We would sometimes say it's the tribe you're from, or it is the mystery school that you previously graduated from. You know, so this whole thing is like a flow, a journey from when you're born, you're not a blank slate. You know, so you come into the life with certain essence, certain characteristics, qualities. We could say you come into the life on a certain point on the wheel of life. But in the current life, you're moving to a different point on the wheel of life. And that would be represented more by the archetypes, by the gods, the goddesses associated with Venus and Mars, and in the long run, toward the rising sign, the life purpose themes of the mystery school associated with the ascendant. You know, so when I have that person come up to me and say, you know, what's your sign? So, well, my sun sign is blah, 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 but I come from the moon position, and actually my Mars position is Scorpio, you know, so I'll talk more about that. And I'm a Libra rising, you know, so basically I try to get the conversation going like that, that we're not really dealing with sun signs at all, because it's far too simplistic. And Michael, even more so, the majority of the descriptions that are given to sun signs tend to be the shadow expression of those mystery schools. And they're not really getting into the depth of what the purpose of that place on the wheel actually is.
So really, this is really about what's our intention, our purpose coming into this life, and how do we find meaning and develop that purpose in this life? Can you deepen that conversation a little bit?
Well, the whole understanding and idea behind intent is fundamental here, which is why we've never looked at there being any usefulness to a more deterministic approach to astrology. You know, so you can't use statistics. You can't quantify it that way, because that's not taking into account the intent. You know, so therefore, if I'm talking to, say, 12 guys with Mars and Scorpio, the intent for all of them would be similar. However, each of them would have their own journey, depending on their lineage, depending on what their cultural conditioning was, depending on what type of family they were born into, as to whether it's easy or hard to get to be able to accomplish that intent. So therefore, of course, we're making the assumption here that when you get born, there is a purpose to it. You know, that you can act, you can figure out in some way, you can tune into what the original intent of your life is, and that there, the journey does have a goal, that there is a place on the wheel that we came into the life to reach. And the horoscope actually gives a remarkable set of instructions for that, you know, like here's how to do it. Here's what you have to go through. And in addition, we don't think on any level that is a good or a bad horoscope, you know. So it's not like being born under a bad sign or something. I mean, I think that every horoscope is the exact, precise, perfect set of conditions for the unfoldment of that person's soul.
Mm, beautiful. You talk a lot about the turning of the ages, and I kind of look at that as around the big event that happened in 2012. But it gives a greater perspective, a huge perspective, and I'd love it if you could talk about this time that we're in, because obviously it's a time of things seem to be speeding up, great change, great ups and downs, and peaks and valleys. Talk about this whole turning of the ages that you speak of.
Well, the largest cycle that that is based on the actual physical Earth in space, relative to the sun, relative to the solar system, that is apprehendable by our senses, is what's called the precessional cycle. It's approximately 26,000 years. And that it's based on, you know, physically and experientially based upon the tilt and the wobble of our Earth in space. It comes directly from the sacred geometry of our Earth in space. So this 26,000 year cycle is really important. So the way of determining turning of the ages is depending on how you divide that 26,000 year cycle up. Most of the world would divide it up relative to solstices and equinoxes. So it's like four seasons, you know, and it's pretty universal around most of the world that there are four seasons. You divide it by four. And so then you have like different turning points in the 26,000 year cycle. And it's based upon when the solstices or equinoxes align with the galactic alignment, which is when the center of the galaxy is lined up with certain things. It's good. So we actually have a 5-day course, you know, trying to show people how this cosmology operates. But ancient people, traditional people, have known this, and they've done it from different ways. The Mayans certainly knew about it. They have remarkable cross checks for it, including the zenith tube that is there at Chichen Itza when the Pleiades are directly overhead at the zenith on certain dates. Then they know the 26,000 year cycle is, you know, near the end or the beginning. But when you divide it by four, then you go back about 6,500 years. And that was we're not just 1 year that's important, but, you know, it's kind of there's maybe generations involved with this, that's the beginning of the recorded history. I mean, before that, it's basically all oral history. If you go back 13,000 years, more and more and more information is now becoming available about the huge events that happened on this planet then. The comet strikes, the Lower Dryas, the raising of the sea level, you know, all, so much stuff that was happening then. We don't really know at this point, although more clues are coming out as far as what would have happened 18,000 years ago and 26,000 years ago. But we're now at one of those junction points. And the 2012 date was one way of addressing it. If we use the tools of modern science, of being able to to locate a specific date that was the center point of the shift, it was actually in 1997. Now, because it's not just one date, it's a range. Mm-hmm. If we use the the 26,000 year calendar, and if we use the 12 by 30 approach to it, you know, 1 degree is 1 degree is 72 years, you know, so you can, that's approximately the lifespan of a human being. So maybe a little more than that, but anyway, 72 for a long time was the archetypal range. So we have thought that the zone of the shift, we're right, still right in the middle of it, but it's from 1962 to 2034. So essentially it's putting 72, you know, half of 72 on either side of 1997. And so then there's all these different dates that show up, including the 2012 one, but also includes the fact that the most recent research has shown that the Kali Yuga genuine end date is 2025. Because that's essentially the bottom of the pendulum that happens at that particular point. Even in non-astrological research, like in the works of a book called The Fourth Turning, it brings up the end date of the American saeculum as being between 2020 and 2025. So there's all of these different other ways you can look at to see how and critically important the time we're in. And even if we go to other fields of endeavor, you know, like the technocrats, you know, this whole idea that by 2029, according to Kurzweil, the singularity will occur, that will be the point where that acceleration to a null point, to a zero point will happen, and human consciousness can be dropped into a chip and will be immortal. Now, I personally, from a shamanic perspective, think that is the most supreme ego trip that anybody could ever come up with. But it's just another way of seeing the importance of the time period we're in now. Probably the simplest approach to it was the one we came up with, that Terence McKenna came up with, you know, that basically you have this curve that reaches infinity at a certain point, you know, information doubling until the information becomes available, becomes infinite, you know, and that's another definition of the singularity. So it's a whole different thing. I don't think anybody knows where this is really heading. Did they really know where it was heading 13,000 years ago? Did they really know that patriarchy would come in and that recorded history would happen? And, you know, those are some of the big changes that happened the previous turning.
So you just mentioned patriarchy, and I know that's a big move. And talk about that from a shamanic perspective, the patriarchal move towards the divine feminine, or whatever you want to call it. I'm not sure how you say it in your language.
I believe that most of what we've been taught in our schools is a very limited view of who we are as human beings. So that if you look back maybe 200 to 250,000 years, we've had the same DNA. But it's only since the last big turning, it came on really strong about 4,000 to 5,000 years ago, did we have what I like to call the triple aberration, which I don't think is evolution at all. You know, I think it's actually what is leading us to this big turning we're in now. The triple aberration is fundamentalistic monotheistic religions, you know, sky god religions. Mm-hmm. The second part of it is domination-based hierarchical patriarchy, mm-hmm. which did not exist until relatively recently. And then the third thing, which hardly anybody talks about, which is patrilineal family descent. You know, all three of those things are fundamentally different than the way 200,000 years of DNA human beings lived on this planet. You know, so that I embrace the view of people like Gambutis and Rian Eisler, that basically our basic nature as authentic human beings is cooperative, gigantic, not based on domination and warfare. That's why I call it an aberration. So to me, it's not about evolution. It's about the pendulum reaching the bottom, which would then be necessary for a reset. And that's how I kind of look at the upcoming time period as a reset. But how that goes, what our planet Earth, what the living being of Gaia, that sometimes I refer to it as that one woman. what is she going to do in order to assist with the reset? You know, it's hard for her to know. Just she's in charge, basically. We're not. So that's why my sub, one of the other organizations I have, which is involved, connected with the Shamanic Astrology Mystery School, is the Renaissance of the Sacred Feminine, of taking people to places that still have a connection to the old ways, to where it's still living in the land, is still living in that connection to what we could call the Sacred Feminine, the Earth Mother herself.
Mm. A lot of the ways that people view astrology in general is looking for prediction.
Yes.
You know, you're saying that it's not quite so clear that can we predict what's going to happen, or is it just something that supports our original intent and soul journey?
Well, the interaction between those two concepts is really part of the great mystery. We've never, and I even before the school started, even in my astrology practice back to 1970, when I was a student of Dane Rudjar, it's never been about prediction. In fact, from a philosophical perspective, I don't even think prediction is even possible. The reason being, there is no such thing as objective time. You know, because even the best astrologer in the world is part of the unfolding, cannot be truly objective to the unfoldment of this one thing that we're in. Prediction is also unfortunately takes the responsibility often away from the person. You know, so that many people have been damaged by astrologers who make predictions about what's going to happen. I think the role of the astrologer is to assist that individual in being aware of what season they're in and what their intent is and how they can then be in alignment with that original intent. So it's like turning the whole art of prediction on its head. So rather than saying, okay, this is going to happen, you'll die at a certain age, you're going to have three wives or whatever, you basically will tune in to what the intent of that individual is, try to, in combination with them, you know, it's a soul-to-soul encounter, and then suggest ways for that person to be in alignment with that intent. And who knows, maybe a prediction here or there might turn out, but then that person is actually working in harmony with the intent of great mystery, the intent of the soul's purpose, which then they're in joining together with. I mean, astrology is basically divination. It's not it's not a hard science. I know there are plenty of people out there, good people, that try to prove astrology, but I think it's a rather foolish endeavor because of the fact that it's really not based on that kind of science. It's a relationship with spirit, and the divination happens when the proper prayer is offered, when the other individual is open to receiving guidance, when there is a harmony between the astrologer and the client, and so that you can, that magic can happen at that moment, which is not subject to some mechanistic scientific approach.
So you can tell when, according to the mm-hmm. your chart, you're looking, when is an optimal time to do something, and when's yes. the time that you might want to lay back and sit on the beach and contemplate the waves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
totally. I mean, in this system, the different planetary forces are allocated to three worlds, and it's you know, basic shamanism 101 understanding. There's three worlds: upper world, middle world, underworld. And the shamanic astrology approach is recognizing all three. So Uranus and Neptune is upper world, Saturn, Jupiter, and the nodal cycles are middle world, and Pluto and Chiron are allocated to the underworld. All of them are different. I mean, each of them is quite different. You know, the middle world ones seem to operate kind of like what's on your resume. It seems to be more logical, but it also includes things like, you know, when does a person physically mature? You know, when do they reach a new stage of life? It's rather similar to a snake shedding its skin. How many skins do you have? Well, we don't really know, but there will be times we know when the skin's going to come off, you know, and then there will be a new phase of life. So the middle world has to do with that. But if a person, say, was in a Neptune cycle, one of the upper world cycles, I mean, from the perspective of that place, this world we're in here has no substantial basis. You know, it's like that Buddhist perception, you know, the self is empty and this whole world is transitory. It's just all rising and falling. So from the perspective of Neptune, that's the truth. Of course, it's only one third of the truth. but if a person is in a Neptune cycle, then if they tried, a practical example, if a person works 100 hours a week or only 10, it won't matter. Because it's really not about objective results. It's not about production, achievement. It would be better in an Neptune cycle if a person had the support for it and the resources for it. That would be when they would figuratively or literally go to India, you know, or go to their place of spiritual pilgrimage or the vision quest or the walkabout. From a more secular perspective, it would be like, well, that's when I'm going to have my sabbatical. You know, should a person be in a profession that would be allowing for that? Now, if a person doesn't know this, if they don't know about the life phase that this example I'm giving, Neptunian, if they don't even know about that, they might think that they've lost it. You know, I mean, I'm confused, and I'll have an individual in the Neptune cycle say something like, "This is really weird. I've been on a spiritual path for 30 years, and I don't know who I am." And then I would basically have the opportunity in a session to say to that person, "Well done." You know, basically, it's okay to not know right now. But then in other cycles, that would not be the advice. In other cycles, you got to choose here. You know, I mean, this is when you're going to have to commit to something. You know, so that would be like a Saturn cycle. You know, commitment is very important in certain cycles. And then if you're in an underworld, if a Pluto cycle should be happening, then it's not. You're not able to understand what's happening with it by anything logical. It's conditions beyond our control, irrational events, conditions for surrender. To use a different image, it would be during a Pluto cycle, it's like something needs to be composted, you know, and out of compost comes new life. And a lot of people try to figure it out. Oh, this must be bad karma. Oh, this must be because I did something wrong. No, Pluto cycle is not about that at all. Now, so to understand the underworld kind of initiation, and also to realize that a surrender to it brings the abundance and the wealth that comes from the underworld. The underworld is not some Christian hell place. It's the lava under the earth. It's the tides below the ocean. It's the deep psyche. It's the what sometimes is called the shadow, but that simply means the portions of our consciousness, content of our consciousness. The consciousness has not come to see. I mean, it's hidden, blocked. It's in the dark. And so during a Pluto cycle, one is forced to look at some of that.
I think that's another thing that lines up with shamanism. I mean, you take from all of these things, but having the underworld or the lower world, the middle and the upper world, and the whole idea of the hermetic principle of as above, so below.
Yes. Yeah. And it all starts there, actually. And which is another way of describing that this type of astrology is not linear. It's not predictive. It's not cause and effect. But rather, it's more similar to a view about correspondences. And maybe a scientific approach for that would be to say that we're in a hologram, so that the largest pattern and the smallest pattern are the same pattern. and that's the part of the Emerald Tablets that I love the most, is that after as above, so below, as within, so without, a little bit further down, it has the statement, and when considering the one thing, there is the pattern, and capital P. Mm-hmm. And I just love that part of it, because, you know, the astrologer combined with the client, or the astrologer in their own individual work with the night sky, with ceremony at certain timings and seasons, they're tuning into that pattern. You know, they're working in harmony with that pattern. They're not controlling it. There's nothing special about the person's power. They just have an opportunity to participate with the exquisiteness and the magic of the pattern. And that's clearly why I love astrology. I mean, I know that I like to say that astrology is the highest of the lower mysteries. Yeah. So what do we mean by lower mysteries? Well, you know, physics, chemistry, psychology. I mean, like basically anything we've ever investigated is the lower mysteries. And astrology is the one that captures as many of them as possible, but it's still the highest of the lower mysteries. So then the question people will ask would be, what are the higher mysteries? Well, it would be like, for example, grace. No one ever earns grace. It's not coming from that place. It's part of great mystery. Or how does self-love actually happen? Or how self-realization actually takes place? I mean, astrology can actually suggest pathways, you know, to suggest what a person's dharma is, or, you know, what version of the masculine or feminine is going to work better for them. I mean, we can certainly suggest that. But as far as that higher mystery element of it, would be rather presumptuous and egoic for an astrologer to act like they know how that happens, because that's the higher mysteries. That's great mystery.
I'd love to hear your thoughts on the drivers. You know, there's a lot of conversation about determinism or free will. And when you talk about what's driving, you know, you could say, is it money? Is it sex? Is it power? Is it? But you talk about it from a sense of meaning and purpose. How does that fit in with the free will versus determinism idea?
Well, the fact that in the shamanic astrology approach, we do identify the quest for meaning and purpose to be of a greater motivation than the other ones you listed. But that also is exactly the same approach that Jung had, you know, in his approach was very different than, say, you know, Freud or Adler and some of the others. And so, yeah, purpose and the quest for meaning and purpose being essential. But he said it best, as far as this question you're asking me. And it was a very simple thing he proposed. He said, free will means to gladly do what you must do.
That's brilliant.
Which I think captures it so beautifully. Free will means to gladly do what you must do. And that's the thing about human beings. You know, unlike the majority of animals, I'm certainly not going to pretend to know what's really going on with cetaceans and squids and octopus, but the majority of animals, they can do is be that animal. But a human being can choose to not participate with their intent, you know. So the free will to not be in harmony with your true nature, you know. So that's why that's this unity between free will and determinism, you know. So there is a set of intentions. There is a certain nature that a person has, but then we can choose to be that or not.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. There's people making millions of dollars teaching people how to find their purpose. And I find that really interesting, this quest for finding our purpose. And, you know, I think it sometimes gets people more confused about their own life and more anxious about their own life, rather than you're doing your purpose moment to moment. But it's looked at like a destination rather than a direction. What's your thought about that from an astrological perspective?
Well, I mean, any approach can be taken to an extreme. Mm-hmm. And there are going to be people, we could almost say, addicted to the workshop junkies or, I just want to keep finding my purpose. The astrological mystery school called Sagittarius, I believe, answers this best, that it's really the journey, not the destination. So that if a person, you know, if they're a Sagittarian type, let's say, a part of the authenticity of a Sagittarian type is to always go down a road they've never gone down before. And it's not even that they're wanting to teach other people how to go down that road, although they are opening that road if somebody else wants to go, all right? But when they get to the mountaintop, the journey's not over, because they notice a higher mountain. And then there's that joy that, oh, now I know what I'm going to do next week. Unfortunately, this whole thing of, you know, what is the truth or what is the meaning and so on, people will lock on to it as a thing. You know, I now have clarity on what it is. And as Carlos was being taught by Don Juan, you know, the third and greatest roadblock to enlightenment is clarity. So if you really think you know how it really is, you're in trouble, you know, because the whole thing keeps expanding out. Nevertheless, I still do think that if a person is living the life that their parents wanted them to live, or the culture wanted them to live, or their spouse wanted them to live, and it is really not their true nature, then it's really an amazing thing to be able to gift someone with the freedom to really explore their true nature. Mm-hmm. You know, there's an element in what you're asking me, though, that I think is important, and that is that there are individuals, maybe there could be a woman with a lot of Virgo, whose sacred work is the fact that she's a single mother. Mm-hmm. And that is her sacred work, without question. If the child reaches maturity, then at that point we address, okay, so now what is your sacred work? You know, it's like then there's another thing that opens up there. But still, from the Virgo place on the wheel, the central question is, what is your calling? What is your sacred work? Different people have different places on the wheel. Some people are just explorers of our definition of the Scorpio Mystery School, having the courage to go to the edge of aliveness for its own sake. It's not for anyone else. It's just to find out where the edge is for you. That's a purpose also.
Yeah. Just, we're getting towards the end of our time, but I just wanted to throw out another little question to look at. And that's the whole area of, how to say it, where we're going as a species. It appears that consciousness itself is going somewhere, that there's in the whole universe, some desire for coherence, which I would say we were mostly decoherent with nature and the universe as a human species.
Right.
What are your thoughts about the direction that we're going from a shamanic astrology perspective?
There's two ways that I can answer this. One is to go back again to my mentor back in the 70s, Dane Rajar. And This has been foundational in my understanding from the very beginning. Around 600 BC, something happened on this planet. It was actually represented by the triple conjunction of Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto. And at that point, all over the world arose concepts around individual consciousness. It was even the time period when personal horoscopes first showed up. I mean, before that, human beings were mainly clan, tribe, not individual enlightenment. And so then you have all over the world, we have the Buddha, you know, we have Lao Tzu, we have Zoroaster, we have Socrates, Plato, you know, basically all these developments that happen. And from there, we've reached the point we are now where it's all about me, you know, it's like such an individual enlightenment kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Well, Rudyard thought that was the antithesis. So the thesis was the clan, tribe, and no individuals. And, you know, where, and then the antithesis was where we're, you know, the extremes that we've gotten to now. And then he proposed a synthesis that he called the globalization of consciousness, which mm-hmm. is basically a re-entry of individual in back into a collective, which is the whole planetary family. So, I mean, I think that's the direction it has to go. And the crisis that we're at right now is, will we actually make it to the thesis? I'm sorry, to the synthesis.
Synthesis, yeah.
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 And then to a kind of unity consciousness.
Which is both together, you know, individual yeah. and global.
Right. It's not a suppression of the individual. It's a... Mm-hmm. Compassionate, interconnected, interbeing kind of thing.
Right. And then yeah. the other thing is, and this is what I think is going to be the main dialogue, and I think it's unbelievably important in the shamanic community this be addressed, which is the trajectory of the technocrats, the trajectory of those that wish to... have eternal life through downloading consciousness into a computer chip, that's going to keep growing and growing, you know, with the development of 5G, with the development of linking everything up with the Internet of Things. And I mean, that seems to be happening. I mean, now in China, they have facial recognition on 1.2 billion people. And that's just increasing and increasing. So I think the function of the shamanic community is to remind us that we're carbon-based and that life, death, going through the processes of nature and the cycles and seasons of our connection to this planet Earth as part of it, not separate from it, not the lords of it, but part of it, is our contribution at this point. And then hopefully there will be a synthesis of the best of the technology, but not losing track of the fact that we are living, breathing, living and dying and living and dying carbon-based life forms, of which there's no way it could be digitized. We're not digital.
That's great. Well, I'm so grateful for your wisdom today, Daniel. I just want to take a second to see if there's any last thing. We could talk for days, I know, but any last thing you'd like to share with our audience here today?
Well, I mean, probably the most important thing would be to make sure that you do spend some time on the land with the sky, mm-hmm. to not lose touch with that kind of connection that we have, because I believe that our 200,000 year DNA essence is linked to the patterning of the sky. I mean, you brought up as above, so below. Well, I mean, quite frankly, if you look at the patterning of the sky, it matches, it correlates with the patterning of our own psyche. And there can be usefulness in knowing those patterns. I mean, the Egyptians felt if you didn't know after you die and go into the bardos, if you didn't know whether to turn right or to turn left, that you might be in some trouble, you know? And so that is reflected in the cosmology when you learn about the galactic alignment and the way the constellations are operating over time.
Yeah.
So this remembering our connection to.
Yeah, I was just going to say it's about our connection, which of course is mm-hmm. the basis of shamanism. You know, it's an animistic, nature-based practice. So mm-hmm. it's very much at the heart of it. Well, Daniel Giammario, my friend, it's really great to spend time with you and share your wisdom with our listeners. I want to tell our listeners that you can also go to shamanismsummit.com/upgrade and own this for yourself with all these great wisdom teachers. And to all of you who are listening, and a special thanks to Daniel for this segment of the Shamanism Global Summit. Thank you so much.
I loved this conversation. Thank you, Michael.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Bye for now.
Thank you for joining us for the Shamanism Global Summit, brought to you by the Shift Network. For more information about joining our global community who are awakening to their divine humanity and taking inspired action, visit theshiftnetwork.com. To learn more about the entire Shamanism Global Summit collection of teachers and healers, or to add all these interviews to your personal library, visit shamanismsummit.com/upgrade. Thank you again for gathering with us and for sharing this empowering path with your friends and family.